Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Good morning, everybody. Guess what? It's not Pledge Drive. I'm happy to report that this is a regular as per usual show in which you can call and be on the air. I'd love to hear from you, your comments, your questions. The number to dial, 888-914-9149. We are open for business, 888-914-9149. But I must tell you how grateful we all are here at Relevant Radio for your generosity. Once again, you came through. It was wonderful. Our goal, as you know, is $3 million. And as of this morning, the latest figures that I've got in front of me show that we wound up at about $3.1 million when everything was said and done by, let's say, over the weekend. By the way, if you didn't get a chance to make your pledge during Pledge Drive, this is not Pledge Drive. We're getting back to regular programming. But if you were traveling or ill or something else was going on and you couldn't make that pledge, you can always still do it. We'll hold the door open for you for a little while. And the way to do that is go to relevantradio.com or use the Relevant Radio app. I won't burden you with that other phone number, but here's my phone number, 888-914-9149. This is the number you can call to be on the air with me, 888-914-9149. I have a note that came in actually just in the last day or so. This is from David, who says, I saw a story about Alexander Dugin's daughter being killed in Moscow by a car bomb that was meant for him. I'd never heard of him, but the article on the web said that he was the quote-unquote spiritual advisor and political philosopher and strategist for Putin. It piqued my interest, he says, since I was always interested in what Putin's real reasons were for attacking Ukraine and building back the Russian Empire. And he sends a link to an article. I haven't had a chance to look at the article yet, but he says, it's an interesting read. He says, I believe Putin is a criminal and a murderer. However, I do not believe, as some contend, that he's trying to take over the world. I do believe he has warped ethical and moral reasons for the war in Ukraine. But the article indicates that Dugin is most concerned about Western liberalism affecting the entire world, including Russia, China, Turkey, and Iran. Hence his view of a Euro-Asian alliance. Some call this the rise of the new axis to combat Western ideas on everything you're talking about on your program that affects us as Catholic Christians. I'm interested in your opinion. And he mentions that we saw each other at the Franciscan University Defending the Faith Conference. He's been going to that for 12 years now. Well, thank you, David. First of all, I appreciate you taking time to write to me. I hope I don't disappoint you with my answer. I don't intend to, but I might. I don't have an opinion on this issue regarding Putin and his real reasons, because everything I read from any given side is contradictory, and I don't think anyone really knows. They don't even know, of course, who was behind this assassination. Was it really intended for Alexander Dugin? Was it possibly something aimed at his daughter? Possible. And everybody's got a take on this, and I don't find any of them particularly satisfying. So I'm taking a wait-and-see approach, and I don't know whether, you know, in due time we'll have something that is verifiable that we can say, well, this is his reason. I don't know if we can really know. And it, to me, it's all the more mysterious what's going on because of the consecration of Russia and Ukraine to the Immaculate Heart of Mary. Pope Francis did that a few months ago. You may remember that. We covered that in detail. So for me, I'm taking a wait-and-see approach. And for the time being, everyone's opinion is in question right now. I don't really think that anybody's got the answer to this question. But I can tell you this much. I'll keep an eye on it. I have been, but I'll keep an eye on this, as many other people are. And if something strikes me as being a for real possibility, I'll share that with you as best I can anyway. There are people who are far more in tune to these matters than I am, but I am keeping an eye on it. I do appreciate your email. Thank you for that. Let's, by the way, I think I gave you the number. I'll give it to you again, 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. This is an email that comes in from Tom, who's listening on the Relevant Radio app. He says, Patrick, as a regular listener, I'm aware of your strong belief in traditional marriage. However, today the House passed a bill, and this is going back a ways, the House passed a bill that would enshrine same-sex marriage in law. So far, there has been a deafening silence from the USCCB and the Vatican, that is the U.S. Catholic Conference of Catholic Bishops. If the powers that be, quote unquote, in the Catholic Church don't plan to speak out forcefully for the teachings of our Lord, it is high time they seek gainful employment in other fields, because it is eminently clear that they are in the wrong business. The synodal way in Germany must be beside itself with glee. And then he goes on to say that the Blessed Mother in certain apparitions has warned about this sad day for Christianity when so many who profess to be his followers either openly or covertly support such going-ons. Respectfully, Thomas. Thomas, I understand. I do indeed. But here again, I don't think the answer is to become, what's the word? I don't know, to become, to toil in this stuff. I wouldn't toil it. I wouldn't toil with this, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Sure, there may be people, bishops, cardinals, whoever, who don't act the way you and I would like them to act. Okay, that's fine. You'll see that, by the way, if you go to the Holy Bible and read the Gospels, you'll see the first bishops, the apostles, who were not acting the way that they should in some cases, and the Lord had to rebuke them for it. So it seems to be that the church always is in a state of, you know, to greater or lesser extents, action or inaction, stalwart defense of the faith or lack thereof. And look, the church is still here. The church is still here. 2,000 years later, Jesus Christ building his church on the rock of Peter. And that's what I would urge you to focus on. You know, if it's disappointing to you that people don't speak out on certain topics when you think they should, okay, fair enough, bring that up with the Lord. Tell him about it. It's his church, after all. So I would make the point simply this. I can acknowledge some of the things that you see as problematic, fair enough, but don't lose your joy over that. Don't become demoralized and defeated. That's not the answer. The answer is to pray for them, pray for the bishops, speak out. Speak the truth in love yourself, if that's something that you're called to do, and it may well be, then do that, and then leave everything in God's hands. Because there's nothing, ultimately, your exasperation, your irritation, the fact that you're irked by these things, that's kind of like useless energy. It doesn't produce anything positive. It just makes you more miserable. So, you know what I'm saying? I'm saying this to encourage you, because nowadays, one thing that's in very short supply, it seems to me, is encouragement. So I want to encourage you in that direction. This is not pacifism. It's not defeatism. It's not stoicism or sitting back and doing nothingism. It's just simply channeling your energies into a direction that you can do something good with. Those are my thoughts. Thanks for writing to me. Let's go to Sam in Athens. Automatic for the people. Sam, welcome.
Automatic, Patrick.
Indeed, sir.
I have a question on Philippians today.
Okay.
On 4:13, does it mean that I can do things that strengthen me, or does it mean things that Christ strengthens me to do?
Well, let's back up a few. Are you talking about Philippians 4:13 specifically?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So let's back up, and I'll start with 4:10 to give some context here. I rejoice in the Lord greatly that now at length you have received your concern. You have revived, rather, your concern for me. You were indeed concerned for me, but you had no opportunity. Not that I complain of want, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased, and I know how to abound in any and all circumstances. I have learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and want. I can do all things in him who strengthens me. Yet it was very kind of you to share my trouble. My take on that is that this is one of several passages where St. Paul gives us like a list, although here he doesn't really give a long list, but a list of hardships that he had to deal with, being shipwrecked more than once, being flogged several times, stoned, beaten with rods, in starvation, in cold and heat, and just about any extreme circumstance, and he managed to live through all of it. To me, it seems that this is what he's saying. Whether you've got food or lack of food, whether you have comfort or lack of comfort, Jesus will strengthen you so that whatever situation you find yourself in, you can handle it. I think that's what he's saying.
Thank you. That makes perfect sense to me. I guess I was going by another translation or interpretation where it had a comma in there, and it made me think, is this just the things that strengthen me he'll help me do, or does it mean that I get my strength from him? And I guess it's both, though, right?
Seems to me it is. I mean, how could it not be, right? So whatever true strength that he derives from his ministry is coming from God. And that, of course, is, as he says, I can do all things in him who saves me, who loves me. So Jesus is the font, you might say, of strength for him. Well, that's what I think on that issue. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it, Sam. Hope you're doing well. And automatic for the people. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. You can be on the air with me if you call that number. We do have lines open right now. 888-914-9149. Let's go. We have calls lining up right now, but I want to get to some others of these emails. This one's from Beth. She says, Patrick, I was taught in RCIA that God not only forgives, but forgets our sin after sacramental confession. However, I am confused because I thought I caught a bit on your show where you discussed something about how at the general judgment, all of our sins will indeed be made known to all at once. Can you clarify? Thank you. Yeah, I can. I think I can clarify this, Beth, for this reason. It is kind of a pious notion that, and by the way, being pious is good. I have nothing against being pious. I'd like to think that I myself am pious. But it's a pious notion to think that God forgets everything that you did. So when he forgives you, that he somehow forgets it. See, that's impossible according to God's nature. Anything that can be known, God knows it. There's nothing that escapes his notice. So God can't forget anything because that would mean that he's changing in some way. And one of the attributes of God's very nature is that he can never gain anything that he doesn't already have. He can't, as the philosophers would say, he can't move or rise from potency to act. Potency is where you could become something. This pencil could be broken in half. This cup of water could be emptied out. This tree over here that is thriving could be cut down. All of those are changes, not to mention change in the sense of everything getting older. But God doesn't experience that. He can't because he's outside of time and space. But more importantly, because as his nature is, he is these perfections. He is existence. He is beauty. He is truth. He is all these things that we talk about him as. We have certain attributes like that. He is those things. And so because God is infinite, there is no limit to his knowledge. And if he were to forget something, that would be a limitation. That would mean that there's something that he didn't know or that he changed from knowing everything to suddenly not knowing some things. So that's why I say this is a pious notion. And I don't mean to deride it. I'm just saying that it's not really theologically correct to say that. In a way, it kind of reminds me of another pious notion that's unrelated to this, and that is where people have this idea that the Holy Spirit guides the conclaves that elect the popes. The church doesn't teach that. The church doesn't teach that the Holy Spirit is the one who selects the pope. The men who are there in the conclave are the ones who do the selecting. But that has sort of seeped into the fabric of the popular mindset among many otherwise very devout Catholics. And so that would be another example of where something's not true. So God doesn't, strictly speaking, forget anything. And yes, it is true, although I don't relish this idea, but it is true that at the general judgment, as Jesus said, what has been done in secret will be shouted from the rooftops. What is done in darkness will be brought out into the light. And one little detail that I would suggest that we, yeah, careful, thank you. If I wasn't gesticulating so wildly this morning, I wouldn't have bumped my microphone. Sorry about that. One little detail, and that is that there is maybe a division of thought on will everybody's sins, and I'm talking here about the righteous, will all of their sins be made known on the day of the general judgment? We know that the sins will be made known, and I personally hew to the view that it will be the case for those who are damned, those who wind up in hell, that all of their sins will be publicly disclosed, but that in his mercy that the Lord will not do that for the saints who are the blessed in heaven. So that's my take on that issue. Hope that's helpful to you, and thank you. Let's go now to Joseph in Minneapolis. Good morning, Joseph.
Good morning. Good morning, Patrick. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a friend who had a conversation this weekend who was born Catholic, raised Catholic, and is in very much a situation like I was at one time. I was away from the Catholic Church for about 15 years. I drifted in. Mm-hmm. But we had a conversation this weekend, and she was asking me about purgatory and the teachings on that, and she wanted to know who wrote Maccabees, and I've been doing a little digging, but haven't really had much success, and I knew you would be the person to talk to regarding this, and if there's anything else that you'd care to add that, you know, that might be helpful in, you know, the discussion that she and I had, which I did share with her about the quote from Revelation, and also that Paul tells us how, you know, the comment about the burning through fire, but those right. who are saved will not be burned in that way, etc. So that being said, if there are things that you might be able to expound on, and particularly her question was who wrote Maccabees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's an easy one to dispatch. First of all, we don't know. That information not only is not given in the book itself, but there's no tradition, certainly no apostolic tradition that indicates who wrote it. And this would be distinct, let's say, from the Gospels. The four Gospels are anonymous documents as well, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But the church has a very robust, you might say, chain of custody or chain of evidence that attest to the fact that these four Gospels were written by the men, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. I'm aware that there are some scripture scholars who would quibble and say that Matthew didn't really write Matthew, but I'll leave those quibbles aside. But in the case of 1st and 2nd Maccabees, we don't know. We know roughly when they were written, and the thought is that they were written about 100 years before the time of Jesus. And it seems to have been a Jew who wrote this. But beyond that, we really don't know. So I can't help you on that regard. We just don't know. I can suggest for further research in conversations with this lady or anyone else, there's a book that I have benefited greatly from over the years. It's called Guide to the Bible. And it's, I just want to make sure I give you the correct author's name. And I'm just looking for it here on my desk. And wouldn't you know, I don't see it here. Maybe what I'll have to do is get it from the bookshelf across the room here. No, I think I can get it. Okay, so here we go. So the book is actually not called A Guide to the Bible. It's called Inside the Bible. And the author is Father Ken Baker. And what's nice about this book is every single one of the 73 books of the Bible has a brief chapter, every single one of them. And in it, he gives us, at least as far as we have information, who wrote it, when it was written, where it was written, who is it written to, what kind of writing is it, what kind of literature or history or chronicles this is, what was the purpose of this book, and a few other interesting details along the way. So if ever you have a question about a given book of the Bible, this is a handy reference guide for somebody like me who is not a scripture scholar. So that might be a book you'd want to pick up. Now, you had a second part of your question about purgatory, and I don't remember now what it was.
Well, I was wondering if there's anything else that you might care to expound on regarding teachings that are not of the Catholic Church and how they look at our, you know, the teachings of purgatory. But the other thing I was going to ask is regarding the books of the Bible that were the seven books that were removed. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't really know the arguments for and against, and I'm sure that that might be useful information if you can expound a little bit on that, because I'm not as informed as I should be. So
no problem, and I can do better than expound, and I have a break that I've got to take right now, so let me point you to somebody who has expounded at great length, and it's very helpful. So a book by Gary Michuta, his last name is M-I-C-H-U-T-A. The book is Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger. And it's a reference there to the seven books of the Old Testament, the deuterocanonical books that are omitted by almost all Protestant versions of the Bible. And he gives the background and history, and he even takes up the polemics against the deuterocanonical books by typically by Protestants, not only by them. And he responds to some of the objections that are made to, well, this book doesn't belong in the Bible. So he responds to those objections. And I think the book's quite good. So since I have to take a break, I'll leave it at that. But two book recommendations for you, Joseph. And I think either or both of them you're going to find very helpful. So that book, again, called Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger by Gary Machuda. And he has also written other books on this general topic about the deuterocanonical books. So there may be other ones there that will be of interest to you. Thank you, Joseph. We are not in pledge drive, which means you can call and be on the air with your comment or question, 888-914-9149. I'll be right back. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Okie dokie. Welcome back. The number again, 888-914-9149. You know who this is, Cyrus, right?
No.
It's the Cars.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do they this do? Is, they don't do a lot of guitar work like this.
Oh my gosh, that's what they were known for.
Really? This?
Lots. Of,
that sounds. It almost sounds like a Tom guitarist. Petty beat. I don't know. There's something Tom Petty-ish about it.
Yeah, it was an interesting and oddly syncopated song, but that's what I like about it. If you listen at the beginning, it has an odd sort of offbeat opening, but then it really picks up. So, yeah, I'm glad you don't. Well, I shouldn't say I'm glad you don't like it, but
well, it was a little touching. It was a little touch and go there, but I would have guessed it was Cars eventually.
Yeah, if you listen to it a few times, you'll really like it. Let's get back to the phones. The number again, 888-914-9149. How about Bloomfield, New Jersey, to talk to Richard? Hello, Richard.
Oh, hi, Patrick. I'm going to try to make a point. You had not a conversation, it was an email, and somebody was mentioning the law that condones same-sex marriage, mm-hmm. and I think he was upset that maybe the Pope or the hierarchy is not speaking about it.
Right.
Right. Okay. Now, one time, years ago, a psychologist said to me, silence is approval. Now, I think he meant the conversation was about maybe a small group of people or possibly two people. Somebody makes a comment that goes against your beliefs, religious, political, whatever. If you don't comment, if you're silent, that's akin to approval. So I kind of believe that. Now, the thing is, if you take it on a higher level, so let's say with the Pope, and he makes no comment on this, I'm not saying that he's approving this new law, but it will be interpreted by many people that he is approving it because of his silence. That's what mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah, I don't
what
disagree.
Do you think?
Yeah, I don't disagree. The email that I read from the gentleman a few minutes ago, he was expressing, you know, his disappointment that the bishops of this country and the Pope, and I'd have to go back and read to see if there was someone else, but he was disappointed that they're not speaking out. And certainly people that you would expect to speak out on a topic and don't, it raises the question, well, why not? And one possible answer is, well, perhaps they don't speak out against it because these people actually are not against it. Now, I'm not saying that that's necessarily the case. It could be in some cases. But people without any information will often leap to the worst possible conclusion. So what I was saying in my response, Richard, is, yeah, I mean, there's a sometimes you do have to speak out. It's necessary. I was telling him he should speak the truth in love. We should all do that to the extent that we are called upon to do so and can do so. But what I was trying to say to him is, even if those in authority don't do so, don't let that demoralize you where you find yourself feeling deflated and defeated. And ask the Lord to give those bishops or whoever the figures are the courage to speak out when it's necessary. So I don't disagree with the point you're making at all, but that was a little bit beside the point with the conversation I was having with him through his email, and that was suggesting that for his sake, even if he feels disappointed by those who fail to speak out when he thinks that they should, it shouldn't deter him from continuing to be a good, faithful Catholic. Do you see the connection now? Does it make more sense?
Right, I agree with that. You can't let it get you down, basically, and you know, just. But we do look for leadership in our church, and I expect comments on, you know, important issues.
Mm-hmm.
Now, look, somebody, my the local paper around here a few months ago, our Archbishop, or I think he's a step above that, which I forget what it is. But he made a comment that if we speak out on this particular thing, it's going to separate Catholics from the rest of America, or it's going to isolate us, or something to that effect. And what came to my mind was Jesus said, and I know you don't use this in every case, but he did say, I came to bring the sword. Division, which means, I think, standing up for what's right, even though it's an unpopular position, and it may put the Catholic Church behind the eight ball, you know, as, you know, I think that's what the bishop was worried about. Mm-hmm. But so why? You know, that's the way I see it. That's what we're here for. That's
let
what
me
Jesus
give you
died for.
Let me give you some historical context that may help. I think it will shed some light on what might be going on. And I'm not saying necessarily in the case of these two items that the person who wrote to me was talking about per se, but rather that there are times when it appears as though the person who should be speaking out isn't and is at fault for not doing so. But I'll give you an example taken from history. So I'm sure you've either read or you're familiar with the Diary of Anne Frank, right? The Jewish girl who was hiding with her family in an attic in Holland during World
yes,
War II.
I am.
Okay, right. So it seems like everybody, I first read her book when I was in grammar school, had a big effect on me. Well,
Yeah.
So the background here is that there has been a great deal of opprobrium dumped on Pope Pius XII saying that, why didn't he speak out? Why didn't he get on the balcony of St. Peter's and denounce Hitler and denounce Nazism? And why didn't he speak out publicly against what was happening to the Jews? Now, the actual historical record shows that Pope Pius XII did a tremendous amount, maybe more so single-handedly than any other individual person did during that time. And he saved countless thousands. In fact, the Israeli government said that they reckoned he saved about 600,000 Jewish lives. So they planted a living memorial of trees to him and his honor when he passed away. And so he did a tremendous amount behind the scenes, but he didn't come out and denounce publicly something that he was very much against. And he worked behind the scenes. Now you may say, well, what does that have to do with Anne Frank? Well, Anne Frank was rounded up by the Nazis as a result of one Sunday, and I believe this was in 1942, one particular Sunday, the bishops of Holland determined that they and all the priests in their parishes on this particular Sunday, from the pulpit, we're going to publicly denounce Hitler and denounce Nazism and the roundup of the Jews and all the horrible things that they were doing. And they did that. And the reaction that it provoked was so horrible that countless thousands more Jews died because the Nazis were so angry about this that they said, all right, fine, we'll do 10 times more than we've been doing. And that's why Anne Frank and her family were caught up in this dragnet and why she was sent to the concentration camp and why she and her family died. They very likely, almost certainly even, would have survived had it not been for that full frontal assault that the Catholic bishops and priests courageously did. I give them high marks for their courage, and I'm sure it cost a number of them their lives as doing this. But Pope Pius XII, he was aware of this. There's a brand new book out. I just got a review copy a week or two ago. It's Pius XII in the Holocaust. And it's a meticulously documented history of what's going on. And in his own diary and other writings, he was agonizing and saying, I would love to come out publicly and say something, but I know if I did, more Jews would die. And so he had to make a decision based on prudence and the information he had available to him. And he knew what had happened in Holland. So he chose a different course of action. And he's criticized for it, not by me. I think he did exactly what I would have done in that situation. But some people said, well, silence is consent, and you went along with it, and you didn't say anything, and why didn't you say anything? When in fact, it's a misreading of what really happened and what he really did. So all I'm saying in this context, Richard, is there's sometimes more going on than we realize. And I'm not saying this to exonerate lazy or negligent prelates. If there are lazy and negligent prelates who should be speaking out, then, you know, God have mercy on them. But sometimes, and this is where you and I can't really know, but sometimes there may be things happening that we're just not aware of. So it might look as though they're lazy or negligent, or worse, that they even agree with this, when in fact they really don't. And I would give Pius XII's example as food for thought. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's a great answer. Yeah, I mean, I don't know what to say.
Yeah, well, I'm not trying to stump you. Just to say, there's sometimes it's easy for us. I know it's easy for me to place blame and say, well, you know, why didn't he do this? Why didn't he do that? Because it looks one way from my vantage point, but I found out later sometimes. Oh, that's not really what was going on. It just looked that way to me. So, anyway.
Well,
I'll give you the last
word. It gives me a little peace. I like that. Good. I have to ponder over this.
Fair
Thanks
enough.
A lot.
You got it, Richard. Thank you. Always enjoy our phone calls. 888-914-9149. How about Kirsten now in Beaverton, Michigan? Good morning.
Good morning. So I have a question for you. My brother and I were both raised Catholic.
Okay.
And over the years, he kind of drifted away from the Catholic Church. And in the last 5 years, he kind of picked up on Bible-based Catholic or Christianity. And he's very particular about the King James Bible.
Okay.
In the meantime, I grew really stronger in my Catholic faith over the years. And so this just some really lively conversations.
I'll bet.
So my question for you is he has told me several times that the Vatican is shaped like a serpent. And I'm just wondering, this is the reasons why he won't even think about returning to the Catholic Church. And okay. So I'm wondering if this is true. If it is true, why?
Okay. Here's something that you might find interesting. He's saying the Vatican, and he's using the term, probably by that he means St. Peter's Basilica. And probably by that he doesn't even really mean St. Peter's Basilica. He probably means the piazza out in front of St. Peter's Basilica, because St. Peter's Basilica is clearly not shaped like a serpent. So
okay.
he's using terminology that might seem persuasive until you look at it. So all you have to do is go on Google or DuckDuckGo, which I prefer over Google, and just type in Vatican, and then click on images, and you'll see not only maps of Vatican City State, which looks nothing at all like a serpent, It's an oddly shaped piece of land that's bordered by a wall on most sides. And you'll see St. Peter's Basilica. That might be what he's saying as Vatican, although that's not technically the Vatican. And that doesn't look like a serpent. But if you look at the piazza, you'll see that there are two colonnades that extend outward from St. Peter's Basilica. If you've ever been to Rome, you've seen them. And they kind of curve out, one on each side, sort of a semicircular colonnade on each side. And then it opens onto the Via della Conciliazione, that long avenue that Mussolini built, by the way. There used to be buildings there prior to World War II. And Mussolini knocked those all down and built this grand boulevard all the way out to the Tiber River. But in any case, those colonnades, he might say, well, that looks like a serpent. No, it doesn't. I mean, those are intended to be the open arms of the church embracing the world. So the meaning of those colonnades is like a hug or an embrace, the Catholicity, the universality of the Catholic Church extending outward to the whole world. Now, okay. That's about the only thing I can think of that has an even slightly curvy appearance to it. So maybe you can just point that out to him and say, what on earth are you talking about? And so yeah. What if a snake can curve and this colonnade curves, what on earth does one have to do with the other? The answer, of course, is nothing. So what I'm driving at here is it's not difficult to deflate some of these kooky ideas. I'm not saying your brother is kooky. I'm just saying he's gotten a hold of some kooky ideas. Now, let me give you a book recommendation, that is. It's called Catholicism and Fundamentalism by Carl Keating. Have you heard of that book?
I have.
Do you have it by chance? Because if you have it, I would dust it off.
I do not.
Okay. I would recommend you get that book and maybe get a copy for your brother if he'd be willing to read it. And you can... Cyrus is telling me something. Okay. Cyrus, I'm going to have to look at what you're telling me. Cyrus will tell me during the break, and I'll check it out. It has something to do with what we're talking about right now. But I get that book because in it, what he does is he expands upon many of these kind of, as I say, kooky ideas and wild-eyed theories about the Catholic Church, and he responds to them in a very documented, detailed way. And it's an interesting and fun read, too, because you'll learn a lot about the Catholic faith as you read the book. So Catholicism and Fundamentalism, the subtitle is The Attack on Romanism, quote-unquote, by Bible Christians, quote-unquote. And it's published by Ignatius Press. I think that book in one volume will help you a lot.
I appreciate answering the question.
Okay. Cyrus, do you want to intervene here with anything before we go to the break?
I sent you a photo. Let's take a look at it at the break, and okay. You can tell me if I'm wrong.
If you're all wet? Okay. I'll take a look at it and see. The serpent at the Vatican. Let's see. That. Okay.
No.
All right. No. I get it, but that's not the Vatican.
I think that's what she's talking about.
Yeah. Okay, Kirsten, excuse me. I have some further thoughts because now I see the specific thing that he's talking about, and I will share that on the other side of this quick timeout. Thanks for that, Cyrus. That's a good pickup. I'll be right back. Let me ask you, can the Catholic Church have a future if we Catholics don't understand our past? Experience history the way it should be taught in a free online class from Christendom College. Just go to principlesclasses.com.
Get connected to the conversation. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
All right. I have further information. Thank you, Cyrus, for what you sent me. Now I understand what this lady's brother is referring to, and I have seen this before. So this is in the Paul VI audience hall. And if you look at, just type in Paul VI, the V-I, Paul VI audience hall in Rome. So this is not the Vatican. It's not even the Bernini columns out front. This is the audience hall in which if you stand in the back of the audience hall and you look toward the stage, it does look like a snake. It looks like a cobra. So there are two bizarre stained glass windows on either side that are shaped like eyes, and they have a pupil in the center. You look at it and you tell me what you think. And the lights above, they kind of, they go down to, they're like track lights, I guess you'd call them. And they go down to where the stage is, and it kind of looks like the head of a snake. And it comes down to where the stage is, and there are two fang-like concrete pillars that are wider at the top and narrow at the base, so they look like teeth, and they're set inside this sort of white concrete frame that looks like a mouth. And if that's what the brother's talking about, and apparently it is, that does indeed look like a snake. And it's the weirdest, strangest,
why,
most inappropriate kind of thing that I've seen. Well, here's why. Well, here's my thought on why. There, how do I say this? Since the time of the Second Vatican Council, there was a resurgence, and even during the time of the Second Vatican Council in the 1960s, there was a resurgence of the heresy of iconoclasm, which was an ancient heresy, and it was finally stamped out by the church in an ecumenical council, the Second Council of Nicaea in 787. But it was this notion that anything that was traditional, especially things like icons or images in particular, this is what the iconoclastic heresy was all about, was the use of images to depict Jesus and Mary and the saints, etc. So the heresy held that this was blasphemous because God condemned idolatry. You can read about that in Exodus chapter 20, where he forbids idolatry. So it's a mistake in thinking that any image, even sacred images, are necessarily idolatrous. And that's not true. And the church had to make that point repeatedly. But since the time of the Second Vatican Council, it had a resurgence in some circles in the Catholic Church. And much of what was true, good, and beautiful was obliterated to make way for crazy stuff like this, that you just look at this and you say, what was the intended message of this architecture or within a church? And I was having a conversation about this just this past weekend, just yesterday, as a matter of fact, with a couple of my adult children. And we were talking about the strange asymmetrical churches that kind of swept through not just this country, but elsewhere in the last, say, 30, 40 years, and intentionally doing things in an asymmetrical way to put you off balance, to make things look odd and strange angles and really weird things, not beautiful, not harmonious, certainly not symmetrical, and it introduces a kind of ugliness to it. So all I can say is I deplore that, but it was a very big thing in architectural circles in the Catholic Church, and I think it has largely died out, I hope. But a lot of really even sinister-looking churches were built. So that leads to the question, well, why would they do that? And I can only venture a guess. It's possible that this was just the innocent architectural output by men and women who did not have necessarily a theological axe to grind. They just like bad architecture and they think it's cool and they just don't have any, you know, there's nothing intended by it other than they think it's cool. So let's build some churches like this. And by the way, we don't like the traditional things, so let's get rid of those. That's a possibility. The other possibility is that they really do want to send a message that is deeply, deeply contrary to the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so then that leads me to the question, why would somebody as saintly, as highly regarded, and I do have very high regard for Pope St. John Paul II. He wasn't a perfect pope, that's for sure. There never has been a perfect pope. But in spite of his many strengths and his many, you know, powerful contributions to the life of the church, he made some decisions that I look on and I say, what were you thinking about that? Why would you permit that? And this is one of those things. Now, in this picture that I'm looking at, you'd have to zoom in. But there's another strange thing about this picture in the Pope Paul VI Audience Hall, which is adjacent to St. Peter's. And it is a tableau of Jesus, resurrected Jesus, but it's the strangest, and I would argue the most hideous kind of art, because it depicts Jesus almost as if he's like been burned to a crisp, and everything, it's hard to even really tell what is this, all this other stuff that's sort of floating around. It's hideous. I have no other word for it. It's just hideous and terrible. And it sends a very strange message. Now, only God knows what was in the minds of the architects. I'm not ascribing anything sinister or anything problematic in that regard to Pope St. John Paul II. I'm not. I just don't know what he was thinking. And maybe in heaven I'll find out. But in the meantime, I can look back and say that was not a good idea. Because look at people like the lady who called in. Her brother is scandalized by this. He's got a hold of some non-Catholic literature, website, whatever, and he's seeing this and he's saying, yeah, that does look like a snake. Why does it look like a snake? If it wasn't intended to look like a snake, okay, you'd think that an architect could really figure that out, because the average person can look at it and say, that looks like a snake. But if it was intended, then all I can tell you is, I think we need to expunge that kind of stuff and say, whoopsie, that didn't work. Let's knock that down and let's start over again and do something beautiful and that will lift your mind to the Lord and not dabble in this stuff that is just very disturbing for a lot of people. I can understand why. So that's my take on it. And I'm glad, Cyrus, that you found that, because I was thinking it when he said the Vatican is shaped like a serpent. I was taking it, I guess, a little more literally. But there it is. Those are my thoughts. I'll never be Pope, but if ever I were Pope, and I won't ever be, my wife won't let me, but if ever I were Pope, I'd probably add this to my list of things to do in the first 90 days. Let's have a new audience hall that doesn't look like a snake. How's that for an idea? 888-914-9149. Let's go to E. Frank in Astoria, New York. Hello, E. Frank. Hello, E. Frank. All right. Well, E. Frank is not ready. What can I say? One more time. E. Frank, going, gone.
I have a bad feeling about this.
Yeah. Oh, Monday morning. All right. This message comes in from Kathleen, listening in Milwaukee. Dear Patrick, my uncle is admittedly agnostic after a lifetime. He's 84, by the way. After a lifetime of being a church-going Catholic, he said to me, quote, since God knows all, past, present, and future, why would he allow the evil in the world and allow good people to suffer? I told him I didn't know why, and that he should talk to a priest, because they are the ones who went to school for a bazillion years and would probably have an answer. He didn't bite on that, and he said that he knows too much about religion and it would probably corrupt my faith if he continued. Can you please help me with my uncle? Thanks for all you do. Well, thank you, Kathy. I don't know that I can help per se, but I can show you what you can do that will help him. He's referring to the problem of evil. Now, the Bible uses a term called the mystery of iniquity. The problem of evil is a construct that all people, if they think about it long enough, are going to wrestle with. And it's a very difficult question. It doesn't lead you away from God. In fact, I would argue that the very problem of evil itself, far from disproving God's existence, actually points to the existence of God, because you can't really have true good and evil things if there's not some objective standard of morality. You can have things you like and don't like. Like, if you don't like it when somebody kills you, okay. But if there's no objective moral standard that supersedes creation, that supersedes the material world, then there really is nothing outside of nature. There are just things that happen and you like them or you don't like them. But you can't really say it's evil in itself, like it's intrinsically wrong. It's just something that you don't like. So I can't get into the solution to the problem of evil per se, but I will recommend a book to you. It's called, actually two books. One is called Making Sense Out of Suffering by Peter Kraft. The second book is called Handbook of Catholic Apologetics, also by Peter Kraft and Father Ron Tosselli. And in those books, he actually unfolds this problem of evil argument, which is, how can you believe in a good God who claims to love you and he's all powerful if there's evil in the world? Because that would seem to suggest that either he's not all powerful because he can't stop the evil, or he doesn't really love you because he won't stop the evil. Therefore, some people erroneously conclude, therefore, God doesn't exist. But as I said, the solution actually points back to the existence of God. And there's a lot that needs to be said on this topic. So I'll point you to those books only because I've got to take a break here in a moment. But in the meantime, what I would do is I would help your uncle see, as best you can anyway, that in spite of the problem of evil, in spite of the difficult things and even shockingly bad things that we see in this world, nonetheless, Jesus loves you. As Jesus said, for God so loved the world that he gave his only son, that whoever would believe in him would not perish but have eternal life. So the fundamental answer from God to the problem of evil is love, so much so that he became one of us and died for us. And if you can help your uncle in his twilight years to refocus his mind on the Lord and not upon bad Catholics who give scandal, lay people, priests, religious, there's plenty of scandal to go around. But why focus on that? It's not to say that we don't acknowledge it, but that's not a reason to leave the church or stay in the church. What other people do is not a reason to stay close to Jesus or to abandon him. The thing to do is keep your eyes fixed on him. So maybe in your kindness, you can be praying for your uncle, Kathy, and maybe share some of that information with him, and maybe pray the Divine Mercy Chaplet every day for him to recover his lost faith, God willing. I'll be right back.